Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, as Pope Francis is set to celebrate Holy Mass on Sunday at St. Paul's outside the walls, we speak to the abbot of the Basilica, Benedictine Edmund Power. And following up on that interview, we speak to Australian scripture scholar, Archbishop of Brisbane, Mark Coleridge, who sheds light for us on the figures of Saints Peter and Paul, who he says fought mightily in their lifetime. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Pope Francis was elected a month ago now, and as the days go by, we're getting to know his ways, and the style of his pontificate is slowly emerging. One of his major appointments took place last Sunday, when, as we know, the 266th Bishop of Rome took possession of his cathedral, the Archbasilica of St. John Lateran. And looking ahead, another important celebration is due on Sunday, at the last of the four major Roman basilicas to be visited by the Holy Father, St. Paul's, outside the walls. In an effort to find out more about this visit and about the basilica itself and its significance, my colleague and friend, Linda Bordoni, went round to speak to the abbot there. He's Benedictine Edmund Power. Stay tuned.
Pope Francis, the very day after his election, popped into St. Mary Major. Then he was installed in St. Peter's. On the 7th, he took possession of his cathedral, St. John Lateran. And on Sunday, he's coming to St. Paul's outside the walls. Is there a meaning in this?
Coming to St. Paul's, I would say, is an essential part of becoming Bishop of Rome, because Peter and Paul are the patrons of Rome. They're the basis of the Church of Rome, of which he has been elected bishop. And so, I suppose, proclaiming his election in those two basilicas has a particular importance. The visit to St. Mary Major, I think, was essentially a personal or private visit, not a public taking of possession of that basilica, but an expression of gratitude in the light of his obviously strong devotion to the Blessed Virgin. And St. Mary Major is the first church of the Blessed Virgin in Rome. The Lateran he has to do, because the Lateran is the cathedral of the Bishop of Rome, so clearly he has to take possession of the Lateran Basilica. The visit to St. Paul's has not been billed as a taking possession, but I suppose more as a recognition of the importance of Paul. In Rome, the four major basilicas are called papal basilicas. Some people say collectively they form the cathedral or cathedrals of the Bishop of Rome, and they represent different aspects of the Roman Church and of the papal ministry. And so coming to St. Paul's, although it's the last visit of the four, although the Mary Major, I'm sure he'll celebrate a Mass there at some point, it's an essential part because it recognises that Paul is equally important to Peter, that the Church has never said Peter and then, oh, there's Paul, by the way. It's always Peter and Paul, Peter and Paul. And I think, you know, those two dimensions of the Roman Church are very important. So we're greatly looking forward to welcoming him and to celebrating with him the Eucharist above the tomb of Paul.
You are the abbot of the monastery as well as of the basilica, if I'm not mistaken. You're a Benedictine, and Francis is a Jesuit. How do you view the nomination of a Jesuit as Pope, and what are your hopes for this ministry of his?
Well, I sort of see the Jesuits as little brothers, really, in the sense that we Benedictines, maybe with a little bit of historical arrogance, sort of say, well, we've been around for 1,500 years, the Jesuits only 500. They're much, much younger than we are. But no, that's I'm jesting. In fact, there is a connection, there's a very interesting connection between St. Paul's outside the walls and the Jesuits. And I hope that Pope Francis will, I'm sure he will, recognise this when he comes. It was in the 1530s, if I'm not mistaken, that Ignatius of Loyola, who was making the pilgrimage of the seven churches around Rome with his first companions, stopped here because St. Paul's is one of the seven, and he actually made his religious profession in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls, in front of a mosaic icon of the Blessed Virgin, which we still preserve in the Chapel of the Blessed Sacrament here. And it's known by the Jesuit name, Regina Societatis, in other words, the Queen of the Society of Jesus. And Jesuits come and venerate this icon. There's a stone on the wall of that chapel put there by the Abbotton community to recognise the fact that this occurred. So the Benedictines who are here, we kind of feel that we gave hospitality to Ignatius at that moment, that important moment in his journey. In fact, having a pope who is a religious, who lives the consecrated life, which is, let's remember, a sign of the fullness of the kingdom. It's a difficult life, but it's a great charism, a prophetic charism within the church. We've not had a religious as Pope since Gregory the 16th in the first half of the 19th century, and he was a Benedictine, Camaldolese monk. Since then, there's been no religious until now. And so it's a great honour for us, and I'm sure all people who live the consecrated life welcome the fact that we have a religious as Bishop of Rome.
Now let's go back to St. Paul's. You were saying that it represents a very specific aspect of the Petrine ministry.
Well, I'd say it's the Pauline ministry rather than the Petrine ministry, but the two, the Petrine and the Pauline ministries, find their union in Rome and maybe more directly, personally, in the figure of the Bishop of Rome. It's true that the Pope is normally described as Vicar of Peter, successor of the Prince of the Apostles, successor of the one who is the rock, and therefore the point of unity and stability of the Church, the one commissioned by Jesus to be the leader. And that's all essential and important. But we mustn't forget that before the Gospels were written, in fact, the first books of the New Testament are the letters of Paul, and it's his missionary dynamic, really, that started the theology of the church really growing. And his experience was rather different. He didn't know the earthly Jesus. He discovered the crucified and risen Lord, first on the road to Damascus, and then in the years that followed in his ministry. And what we see in Paul is a constant movement. He was never bishop of anywhere. He's associated with places all over the world, all over the Roman world, even Spain. There's a tradition that he went there. But Peter is more directly linked. He was first in the East, obviously, in Antioch and so on, but then in Rome. Well, Paul went everywhere. And so Paul represents not a stable, rock-like point of unity, but a dynamic, moving point. In other words, Paul, always on the move, is the symbol of the missionary dynamism of Christ's church. The Pope can't just sit comfortably in his great Basilica of St. Peter's and preside solemn liturgies. In the recent pontificates, we see how the popes, beginning maybe with Paul VI, but very strongly in the life of John Paul II, for example, all these trips around the world, because the missionary dynamic is so fundamentally important. It needs the dynamic of stability, the rock, but it can't remain just there on the rock. And therefore, Paul is equally important to Peter as the basis of the Pope's ministry. So it's a Petro-Pauline ministry, I would say.
Very fascinating figure, Paul, but a fascinating basilica you have as well. You were saying the Mass will be celebrated, the Eucharist will be celebrated above the tomb of Paul. There's also another wonderful relic in your church, if I'm not mistaken, the chain.
Yes, the chain is a wonderful relic. At first sight, people see this chain of nine links hanging there in front of the papal altar and think, what on earth is that? Is this Catholic superstition? You can almost see Protestants shuddering at the thought of this. But I've always thought that even if we can't with 100% certainty say, yes, this is the chain that held Paul in his Roman imprisonment 2,000 years ago, if you really reflect on what it might symbolise, you realise how eloquent it is at the spiritual level for various reasons. One is that Paul speaks about his chains several times in the course of the letters, sometimes physically as a physical object or symbol of his imprisonment, which we know he had to endure, but sometimes as a symbol of the suffering in love that he willingly undertook to be identified with Christ in his passion, death and resurrection. Sometimes as something that binds people together in their common faith and love. And so the chain has a number of different aspects to it, all of which are important. What I find, because I always have to give a little homily on it, is how easy it is to preach about the chains of St. Paul and the symbolism of this, a profound theological symbolism that touches the very core of our faith in Christ in his passion, death and resurrection.
St. Paul's outside the walls is the great meeting point between East and West, isn't it? Or it's the ecumenical basilica par excellence. It's outside the walls.
Yes, that's certainly true. I've often thought and spoken on the theme of, let's call it, the topography of Rome, the actual layout of the city and its major basilicas, and the symbolism of their geographical positions. And we've got St. Peter's that dominates Rome in every sense. Its enormity, it's visible from the Alban Hills, 15 miles out of Rome. You see the Dome of St. Peter's or from the airport. It dominates the city. It's the biggest building in Rome. St. Paul's nobody can see until you're quite close to it. Therefore, you see a sort of difference here. You see St. Paul's outside the walls, not really within the city, and not sharing, therefore, in a certain sense, that protective security of being within the walls. But I think that's part of the dynamism of the Pauline missionary spirit. You know, you can't remain within your walls. You can't just protect yourself. Maybe it's a day and an age in which the church has to go out in the Pauline spirit. It has to risk, maybe, leaving the protection of the walls to reach the great majority of humanity that doesn't share that protection. And so our basilica, which is dedicated to ecumenism, partly I think because Peter, great saint though he is, has been taken a little bit by the papal theology and, dare I say, triumphalism in past centuries, the importance of Peter, but maybe it's a little threatening to people who don't share the Roman Catholic perspective. But for them, maybe, Paul is more accessible because he's not within the walls, he's on the fringe and he's always in movement and he's always among the Gentiles. And so the Basilica has been declared by the popes, in fact, as the normal place for ecumenical welcome. And the monks, who've been here for 1,300 years, in fact, have in recent years had this confirmed by the popes that part of their role, guarding the memory of Paul, welcoming all pilgrims who come here, is to be open also to others who are not of the Roman Catholic faith, but who see in Paul an inspiration and a guide in understanding better the crucified and risen Lord.
It sounds like the kind of place that Pope Francis may be particularly comfortable in, for what you have been saying.
Clearly, I would imagine that all the symbolism of St. Paul will be very dear to his Jesuit heart, and that he will respond very strongly to what St. Paul's outside the walls means. And I hope he will recognise in us Benedictines fellow religious, certainly, linked to the Jesuit history, certainly. And I don't know, I would imagine we'll be quite prominent in the celebration. After all, this Basilica of St. Paul's, unlike the other three, St. Peter's, St. Mary Major and the Lateran Basilica, has no chapter of canons like the other basilicas and like nearly all cathedrals in the world. It has a chapter of monks. In other words, instead of a secular chapter, which is a group of canons, and in the case of the other Roman basilicas, headed by a cardinal archpriest, this basilica has a regular chapter of monks headed by an abbot. We actually have an archpriest as well, who has a direct responsibility for the basilica, but has no connection with the chapter of the basilica. So we monks, as chapter of the basilica, I hope will have an important position in the welcoming of our bishop. I've not actually seen the new pope yet, except on television, of course. And so that moment when he alights from his car at the angle of the quadriportico of the basilica will be a very significant moment. I'm looking forward to the moment in which I shake hands with him or kiss his ring or whatever one does, and speak to him for the first time. But having many Jesuit friends, I imagine that there'll be an instant kind of understanding, because with other religious, there is something, even though we come from different religious traditions, with other religious, there's always a certain familiarity, or there's a certain understanding on the spiritual level, which is difficult to say exactly what it is, but it's always there. So I'm looking forward to that spark. I hope there'll be a nice spark when I meet him.
You were listening there to the Abbot of St. Paul's Outside the Walls, Benedictine Edmund Power, who was speaking there to Linda Bordoni. My thanks go to both of them. Now moving on in the programme, given we have the successor of Peter visiting the Roman Basilica dedicated in a special way to St. Paul, I thought I'd ask you to join Australian scripture scholar Archbishop of Brisbane, Mark Benedict Coleridge, to shine the spotlight on these two apostles who, he says, fought mightily in their lifetime.
One of the most striking things about the city of Rome, one of the many striking things, is that wherever you go in the city, you never see Peter unless you see Paul, and you never see Paul unless you see Peter. They're always together. You walk into St. Paul's outside the walls, and there, standing up in the front of the basilica, are big statues of both Peter and Paul. Similarly, you walk into Piazza San Pietro, and again you see heroic statues of the two of them. Not only do we see them represented together like that around the city, but in the church around the world. We celebrate their feast day on one day, 29th of June. And the question is, why don't we have a day for them each? Aren't they important enough, surely, to warrant a day? And yet, here we have them celebrated together in one city on one day. Now, this becomes all the more peculiar and interesting when you recognise that in life, they fought, and they fought about things that weren't just trivial, but went to the very heart of what Christianity and the church are. The first time that Paul meets Peter is in those years after his Damascus Road encounter, when he's knocked down, stripped of power, and when he hears the call to be the apostle to the non-Jewish world. After that encounter on the road to Damascus, Paul vanishes into what he calls Arabia for quite some time, and then eventually emerges from the desert to undertake a mission, his first ever mission perhaps, in Damascus. Again, his life is under attack immediately. He's lowered down the wall in a basket, and away he goes. And then beyond that experience of mission in Damascus, he decides to go up to Jerusalem. Now, for Paul, this was a very delicate moment because he was known to be a persecutor of the church. But he felt he had to go up and meet those whom he calls the pillars of the church. He meant Peter, James and John. He calls Peter Kephas, which was Peter's name in Aramaic, same nickname, means rock. But Peter, James and John were the big three, the Troika, in Jerusalem. So Paul, at this moment, is driven, as it were, to go up and meet them, whom he had almost certainly never met before. Now, he needs a diplomatic bridge, someone who can introduce him to a community who was still highly suspicious of the former persecutor. And the diplomatic bridge he finds is the crucial figure in his life of Barnabas, real name Joseph. Barnabas was his nickname, son of encouragement. So Barnabas it is who takes Paul to meet Peter. And in his letter to the Galatians, Paul says that I went up to Jerusalem to, the word he uses in Greek is historesai, to historesai Peter. Now, this verb in Greek can mean two things, to give information to or to receive information from. I think Paul uses this verb precisely to say, I wanted to hear something from Peter and I wanted Peter to hear something from me. Now, what did he want to hear from Peter? He wanted to hear about Jesus. Paul had never met Jesus. I think when you read the letters, that's clear. He never knew Jesus personally, but Peter most certainly did. So he needs to hear a lot from Peter about the historical Jesus, who he was, what he did, what he said. Peter needs to hear from Paul the real story, from the horse's mouth, as it were, of Paul's own conversion. So here they are, the two of them, for about a fortnight in Jerusalem, telling their stories to each other. Paul then vanishes from the scene. He goes home to Tarsus for a long time, and at this stage he could have plummeted off into the black hole of history. But in fact he doesn't, because again it's Barnabas who brings him back onto the stage as one of the leadership team of Antioch, where the gospel was first preached to non-Jews, to Gentiles. Barnabas was the one sent down from Jerusalem to discern this volcanic and potentially dangerous situation where the gospel is moving out of Judaism into the Gentile world. Barnabas needs to recruit the right kind of leaders, and he thinks Paul. So he goes to Tarsus, finds Paul, brings him back to Antioch, and there for about a year, we're told, Paul is part of the teaching team, the leadership team. Then he becomes part of the first ever Christian mission team to leave Palestine and enter the Mediterranean world. Barnabas was the leader of that first ever mission, Paul's the kind of vice captain, and John Mark is the third member of the team. They again preach the good news of Jesus to non-Jews out there in the Mediterranean world, and this creates enormous controversy in the infant church. And as a result, when they come back to Antioch, they have to go up to Jerusalem, again, to meet with the mother church in this moment of crisis and controversy. So Paul and Barnabas go up, and again Paul meets Peter in what's called the Council of Jerusalem. And it's Peter who eventually stands up and delivers a kind of compromise judgment, really, that the gospel is for the Gentiles, but the Gentiles need to respect Jewish sensibilities on certain counts. So here again, a second moment where Paul meets Peter. And Paul, like everyone else in the early church, deferred to the unique authority that Peter had received from Jesus himself. No one doubted that, certainly not Paul. The third time, and in some ways the last time that Paul meets Peter, is again in Antioch, where Peter has come down and he's sharing table fellowship with non-Jews, non-Jewish Christians. Jewish Christian and Gentile Christian sitting down at one table. Now this undermined the fundament of Jewish religious identity, which was separation of the Jewish and Gentile worlds. Now you had Peter and Paul sitting down as Jewish Christians with non-Jewish Christians, sitting at the one table to eat and to celebrate the Eucharist, therefore. Some of the James Party, as they're called, some of the conservative Jewish Christians from Jerusalem, James was the residential leader of the church in Jerusalem, come down and they say, you can't eat with them. You Jewish Christians have to separate. We have one church, two tables. And Paul says, no, wrong way, go back. You are re-erecting the barriers that God has knocked down in Jesus. Therefore, you are doing the work of Satan. At this stage, Peter and Barnabas agree with the James people who have come down from Jerusalem, and Paul looks a very isolated figure. He has to make a decision. He could have either gone home to Tarsus, just said, it's a bad joke, I'm out of here. Or he could have said, well, you were right and I'm wrong, I beg your pardon, I didn't want to create all the trouble. Or, and this is what he does in fact, he could decide to set up his own mission team. So what comes to birth in this brawl at Antioch is the independent Pauline mission. And the issue that Paul and Peter fight about is really the nature of the church. Is the church a kind of sect within Judaism? Or has it been born from the womb of the synagogue as some new, distinctive initiative of God's? Paul says that Christianity is not just part of Judaism. It has been born, thrust forth, as it were, from the womb of the synagogue as something new that God is doing for all people, not just for Jews, but for Gentiles as well. At that stage, Peter and Paul part ways. Paul will reappear in Jerusalem from time to time, but we don't exactly know what went on there. He will never again return to Antioch as he sets forth on the path of his independent mission. Eventually, the stories of Peter and Paul will converge. Their paths will cross in the most decisive way, because both of them were among the Christian leaders in Rome in the mid-60s who were swept away in the tide of blood that came with the persecution of the Emperor Nero. So both suffer a martyr's death, that much is certain. Paul is beheaded on the way out to Ostia, at what is now Tre Fontane. Peter is crucified in what was Caligula's circus, and that is now St. Peter's Square. Now, what happens in this moment is that in the moment of their death, and Rome is the city of their death, they didn't found the church in Rome, but they died here. In the moment of their death, they find their way so completely and so profoundly to Jesus, crucified and risen, that they find their way to one another. That's the key. They find a communion in Jesus crucified and risen in their death that they didn't and couldn't find in their life. So why does the church celebrate the memory of the two of them so intensely in one city where they're always represented together and celebrate their memory particularly on one day, the 29th of June? Because in this, the city of their death, they become so completely, as it were, immersed in Jesus. They become Jesus, crucified and risen, that they move beyond all their differences and disagreements to find their way into that perfect communion, which is in Jesus, crucified and risen. And that's why the Petrine ministry, the papacy, looks not just to Peter, but also to Paul. Because the Pope, as heir to the witness of both Peter and Paul, the Bishop of Rome, is the prime servant of the communion which they found in death.
Thanks there go to Australian scripture scholar, Archbishop of Brisbane, Mark Benedict Coleridge. And that's all I have time for today. I'm Veronica Scaresbrig. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.